All families have secrets, sometimes even explosive secrets, but it's pretty rare for family secrets to be literally nuclear. In Emily Strasser's case, her family secrets overlapped with American national secrets and with the fateful decision to drop a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima. Emily Strasser is a professor of practice in the English department at Tufts University and also the author of the memoir Half-Life of a Secret. She also presented the first series of the BBC podcast The Bomb. Emily, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thanks for having me.
I did wonder, Emily, whether this might be the first time that the year our guest chooses for The Year That Made Me might actually be a year before they were born, because your memoir, Half-Life of a Secret, is very much about the life of your grandfather, George Strasser, who died before you were born. Could you tell us about George?
So I didn't know that much about George growing up. He had been a farmer. I knew he grew up on a farm. And as I sort of subsequently learned, he went on to build nuclear weapons, working in the Manhattan Project starting in 1943 in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, secret city built for the purpose of enriching uranium. As a child, though, I knew him only through little glimpses and bits of family stories. And so, you know, there were funny stories. There was a bit of a darkness around him, too. As I later learned, he had also struggled with mental illness. And there was this photograph that hung above the bed where I slept when I visited my grandmother's house. And it showed him standing in front of what I now can tell you was a nuclear test blast. It was a mushroom cloud, right? It's hard to pinpoint exactly when I could articulate what that was exactly. But I have this very visceral memory of falling asleep in that room with this sense of awe and fear. It was just a very strange object that was not explained in my family or contextualized, and that didn't align with what I understood my family to be, with what I understood my history to be. And so it wasn't until much later that I started to dig into that history and try to understand who was this man who I only knew in little glimpses.
So how was it that you started to become focused on George, and how did your family respond when you started asking questions?
I didn't really start asking questions until college. I was about to graduate, and I started to remember this photograph with this really like visceral, it just came to me really suddenly. It was like haunting. It kept coming up in my journal. All of a sudden waking up and being like, wait, that's weird. Most people don't have a picture of their grandfather in front of a nuclear test blast on their wall. Like, huh, that doesn't make sense. You know, I went to Quaker school. You know, Quakers are pacifists. Like, we weren't allowed to keep score at recess soccer games because that was considered some kind of violence. I was just like, what the heck? You know, what is that? And so I started off just asking questions and checking out books about Oak Ridge from my college library and reading what I could. The family was, I think, surprised that I was interested. You live with something strange long enough and you take it for granted, but mostly open with me and willing to talk to me about it. The thing is, there was a lot that they didn't know, because my dad and his siblings grew up in a culture and in a place where dads didn't talk about what they did.
And not least because I suppose they might not be allowed to.
Yeah, exactly. No, literally, they weren't allowed to talk about it. And so they just had this very vague sense of like, dad goes to work, you know, he goes through the security gates and he stays there very long hours and then comes home and does not utter a word. Oak Ridge, Tennessee itself during World War II was a complete secret. Like, it wasn't listed on area maps. Most of the people who lived and worked there didn't know what they were doing. They just did whatever job was theirs to do, you know, fix the pipes, pour the cement, file the papers. In my grandfather's case, he was working with uranium because he was a chemist, so he had a better idea than some, but he wasn't, you know, a famous top Oppenheimer kind of figure who had the whole picture. So at that point, it's secret, and everybody in Oak Ridge learns what they're doing on August 6, 1945, when the bomb is dropped and Truman announces this over the radio. Like, it's crazy, right? People are just at work and the radio comes on and tells them what they're doing. In fact, they don't hear it because they're at work. So it's like their wives who are at home or people who are off shift who hear it. So that's 1945. But then after that, there's still a lot of secrecy around the specifics of the work itself. This is what my dad grew up in. But the fact of that being the main project of the town is no longer a secret.
Were you able to get a sense of how George himself reacted to that news, realizing that the work he'd been involved in had resulted quite directly in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in Japan?
I wish it would have been a much shorter book if I had access to that. Like a journal would have been amazing, or a memory. My grandmother had also passed away by the time I started working on this. But I think a question that I was asking the entire time was like, what does it do to us to be involved in this? You know, I was disturbed to be linked to this history that didn't align with the way that I want to move through the world, or the way I had understood my family. And, you know, I did mention that he had struggled with mental health. And so there was sort of a question about, is that a factor? Mental health is complicated. There's a lot of factors that play into that.
Was that a family secret as well?
It's, you know, it's like yes and no. It was spoken of with a sort of clinical distance. Like, okay, there's these problems in our family, and so we need to take care. And if you need medication, then you should take medication. If you need therapy, you should go to therapy. So there was a kind of practical knowledge passed on, which was useful and good. That at the same time, what I understood about my grandfather's mental health from what I'd heard from my family turned out to be much more serious than what had been conveyed in this practical advice that was passed along once I dug in and did some research. And I do think there was a way that the compartmentalization of Oak Ridge, of sort of knowledge in Oak Ridge, that work culture was also being mirrored within the family. So everyone sort of had their little piece of how they'd experienced George. Four kids far apart in age. And so he's going through different episodes at different times when different kids are home. My grandmother in different stages of denial, like only accepting help maybe when things are too out of control to not accept them. And so I think there was a lot of like, you take your piece and then to survive and move on, you shut it down, right? And don't necessarily talk to each other. So there was like uncovering that happened in that aspect too.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Emily Strasser, author of Half-Life of a Secret. And Emily, most people are familiar, of course, with the Manhattan Project, but Oak Ridge, probably less familiar as a name. You mentioned its role as a secret city during the Second World War. Could you also tell us a little bit about what Oak Ridge meant to you as a kid?
So I grew up spending summers at my grandmother's house, which was outside of the city of Oak Ridge. And it was a house where my grandmother and grandfather retired to, although they'd built it as like a second home before my grandfather retired. It was on a lake, just very, very idyllic, long summer days spent, you know, change from pajamas to bathing suit, back to pajamas again, right? Like who needs clothes? Who needs shoes? Just living in the water and living outside amidst a gaggle of aunts and uncles and cousins. I loved that landscape and that home. It really was a home to me. And Oak Ridge was like the sort of weird town that we'd go into every once in a while if it was raining and we needed something to do. We'd go to the science museum where there were like some hazmat suits on display. But I didn't really know much about the history or its significance until I started digging in and found out the ways that this place that I love is then connected to this history.
And certainly that carries a sense of guilt for you, but you also discovered some pretty amazing pride and celebration in Oak Ridge and its culture. Could you tell us what you found about that?
Yeah, it's a weird place. There's a lot of pride in the history, and I think some of that relationship may be shifting as that population is aging out. When I started interviewing people, I was able to interview a lot of people who had worked there during the Manhattan Project, and most of those people are gone. But there is a really strong like pride in the science, pride in feeling that they helped win World War II. A commitment to a certain narrative that sometimes requires not including the history of Hiroshima. There's a festival every year called the Secret City Festival. There's funnel cakes and bouncy houses and things, but you can do tours of the nuclear weapons plant. When I did it, it was the only time in the year that you could get behind the gates of the plant. I actually, when I went on the tour, I made them nervous because I was taking so many notes, I think, and at some point, because I had never been, I'd been researching for years and years and I'd never been able to be inside. And I was asking a lot of questions and writing in my little notebook. We weren't allowed to have recorders or anything. And like two people start flanking me and be like, what are you doing? So I had to pull, you know, the granddaughter card here. So there's a weird sort of kitschy way that the history comes out. You know, there's businesses in town, Secret City computer, auto parts, like beer mugs with the foam coming out in the shape of a mushroom cloud. There's a Catholic church with a Mother Mary outside who's balancing atop an atom. So, yeah, it certainly embraces the history, but I would say one slice of it, a narrow view.
You interviewed many of the people who worked at Oak Ridge around the time that your grandfather was working there. Did you encounter much regret or guilt amongst those people?
I didn't. One of the people I interviewed early on was a man who actually worked in the same lab as my grandfather, like a very small lab during the war. And it was kind of amazing that I was able to find someone who had known him and worked elbow to elbow. And he was sort of very insistent that it was a wartime, that the context was different, and that he was proud of his role. Someone else I spoke to, a woman who had worked as testing for leaks in pipes. So she'd had a much less full of a picture. She was one of these girls, like straight out of high school, who just gets a job at this plant because they just need people, right? So all of a sudden, these country girls who haven't gone to college are coming from rural poverty and given jobs where they're making more money than they've ever made. And some of them are meeting their college educated husbands and finding their way. Like, this is their chance, right? And so I guess that's important insofar as this moment was so formative in their lives because they found their ways off of the farm and into a life of more financial stability, of more ease. But this woman, Colleen Black, I remember she didn't express regret, but she was reflective about, she and her daughter had gone around to like elementary schools and spoke about the history of Oak Ridge. And she talked about how children would sometimes challenge her on, like, why did you do that? Wasn't that terrible that you did that? And she seemed to be sort of like sitting with that question. But I do think it's hard if you've built your life and staked your identity on an entire history to question the foundation of that story.
Emily, we've spoken a lot about your grandfather, but now we are going to come to your life and the year you've chosen as the year that made you. What have you chosen for us and why?
So I picked 2009, and it does relate to my grandfather because it's when this book began. And I think it's also like my work is now. I'm a writer and a professor, and really the book made me a writer. Writing this story of my family taught me how to write and how to research and how to like try to make sense of the complex and entangled and the hidden and the contradictory. So I picked 2009, and I sort of want to start the year a week before 2009.
We can allow that. Yeah, tell us what happened in December of 2008.
Yeah, great. Yeah. So on December 22nd, just a few days before Christmas, there was a massive industrial spill at a coal burning plant that sits like directly across the lake from the house where my grandmother lived, which once she passed on, my family had kept and held in common. So directly across from this house, a waste containment pond that contained toxic fly ash, byproduct of coal burning, ruptured, sending more than 1 billion gallons into the land, into the water, knocked down dozens of homes. Amazingly, no one was killed or injured that night, despite it being a really massive scale spill. It's the largest industrial spill in U.S. history. And so I am, when this happens, I'm at home in Atlanta, where I grew up, on break from college. And my family wakes up in the morning, and there is our little bit of Tennessee, our little bit of the lake, on the cover of the New York Times. And we're just staring at this and locating, like, where's the house, right, in this overview. And it was just this really wild moment when a place that to me was sort of like safe and stable and I thought pristine suddenly is none of those things. Suddenly is vulnerable, suddenly is contaminated. And I wasn't yet making this connection, but as I would later learn, this coal plant was actually built to power the plants in Oak Ridge in the 1950s because they needed more electricity. And so that shook me up, and we wouldn't know how bad that spill actually was for a long time after, because it was a lot of material and it was toxic and people were freaked out, but no one initially died. 10 years later, dozens of workers had died. Hundreds of people were sick. There were a lot of lawsuits about the cleanup process, but that was still unfolding. But I think I mention it now because there was just a sense of ominousness of like, things might be hidden and burst out and take out things that you thought were safe. So a few weeks later, I left to go to India on a semester abroad. I went to the foothills of the Himalayas, where there's a large Tibetan community in exile. I was studying in a Tibetan college there. My roommate actually was from a Himalayan region called Ladakh in northern India. It's a region that has cultural and linguistic similarities with Tibet, but also a distinct identity. And being among Tibetans who were in exile and had this like really, really strong sense of home and landscape tied to a land that they couldn't return to, a landscape that is so intense that it defines so much of how you're able to live, how you worship. It's just like sort of deeply ingrained. And then spending time with my roommate who could return to her home, but similarly had a rootedness that I don't know that I'd ever been so close to before. She comes from this tiny village in a gorgeous place, high, high up in the mountains. And she knew she was going to return there and she wanted to. And we were meeting at this interesting time where we were both students and there was sort of an equality and we're both studying. But I don't know where I'm going next. And that's terrifying and exciting, but I didn't feel attached to going back to like Atlanta where I grew up. But she sort of, I think, felt like, yeah, I'd like to have some adventures, but also how could I not go home? How could I not be in the land where I came from? And I was actually able to visit her village and her family at the very end of that trip for a couple of weeks, which was really, really incredible. And I think a lot of that semester in sort of indirect ways shook me up and helped me to see my own home in a different light and also gave me courage to look at it and to try writing about it. Travel can sometimes cast a new light on the familiar. So when I got home, and I was still, I think, really processing this, like, what does it mean to be from a place and to love a home like that? And when I was trying to think of what was my analog, what kind of home did I love, I didn't think about Atlanta, where I went to school and lived with my parents. I thought about my grandmother's house on that lake in Tennessee, and I thought about that place. But now there was this shadow of this untold piece of it. I had a lot of questions. And as I was at this precipice of like, who am I? What am I going to be in the world? What kind of job am I going to have? How am I going to move through it? I kept feeling tugged to look backwards and figure out where I'd come from. And this image of the photograph kept returning to me.
Emily, what do you make of the fact that the range of responses to what you've discovered about your grandfather is different, that not everyone feels the same way about it as you do?
I mean, I think, yeah, it's a good question. I think we have different responses to history based on what kinds of stories are important to us to make meaning of our lives. Like, there's been a strong thread, at least in this country, of the narrative that the bomb saved more than a million lives, massive, massive numbers of lives on both the Japanese and the American side. And some of the biggest pushback I've gotten when I express discomfort with my grandfather's role is this, like, you don't understand, he's a hero. My grandfather would have been dead, right? My grandfather was on the ship ready to go. So people have this like personal investment of like, you know, because the war ended, my grandfather didn't have to fight in Japan and didn't die. So people, I think, stake their identities on particular stories like that. Now, I can't say about anyone's particular grandfather, right? Like, I have no idea. Neither do they really. But that particular story that so many lives were saved is actually a narrative that was made up after the fact because the U.S. government was uneasy with the public unease being expressed by Americans after Hiroshima. So it comes about, Harry Stimson, Secretary of War, writes an article in Harper's in 1947 that sets out this argument that has casualty estimates that are massively inflated from those that now historians have uncovered were actually being discussed at the time, which I just find, like, the debate about whether we should or shouldn't have dropped the bomb, I almost don't even find so interesting, right? Like, we did, right? So now we just have to deal with what it means to live in a world where we have created and used these weapons and could again. But the fact that people are so invested in that story that historians have now shown was post-war propaganda actually does demonstrate that there is unease about the idea of killing civilians at that scale, because they need to demonstrate how much of a lesser of two evils it was.
What was it like for you to go to Hiroshima, Emily?
It was a really, really powerful trip. I knew from like the very beginning I would need to go, and I was pretty scared to go. So I put it off for years, but also just wasn't ready. So I finally went in 2015 for the 70th anniversary of the bombing. And I took in every art exhibit that was being put up, every museum show, every event I could find in commemoration of the bombing. And then I also was able to meet and speak to Hibakusha atomic bomb survivors. And they were so incredibly gracious to me and generous. I told them why I was there. I told them about my grandfather, and they told me their stories and shared their deep desires that no one ever have to experience what they experienced. These are people who have agreed to recount the worst thing, not only that's ever happened to them, but that maybe any of us could ever imagine happening, or not imagine probably, because it's that terrible, to recount it over and over and over again with the hope that that could prevent the same thing happening again. So I was very moved by that generosity and that welcome.
How did they respond specifically to the knowledge that you were related to someone who worked on the Manhattan Project?
Yeah. You know, for the most part, they weren't as surprised as I expected. There was a funny thing I discovered that, like, I wasn't the only one who sort of was tugging at this thread. While I was there in my guest house where I was staying, there was another woman who had, like, her grandfather had worked at Hanford, Washington, which was another of the sites that created plutonium. Everyone around town kept saying, like, oh, you just missed Ari Besser. His grandfather was the only man to have flown on both the Hiroshima and Nagasaki missions. And so there's like all these little, like, I don't know, nuclear grandchildren like running around and being like, how do we make sense of this history? Right. So it really made me reflect on like, what is like the point of this? What am I, you know, what am I doing here? And so mostly I think they weren't fazed by it, and they were glad to share their story with me as with someone else. But it challenged me to move beyond the personal story. And I think it was at that point in that trip that I started to think, okay, I've taken this as far as I can. I still have questions that I would love to learn the answers to, but I can live with not knowing. And the more urgent question now is the what next, which is really like what the Hibakusha were sort of pointing to. Like, okay, yeah, your grandfather did this, and this is the cruelty of war. Let's make sure it doesn't happen again.
That is fascinating. As is your memoir, Half-Life of a Secret. As has been speaking with you today, Emily, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. Emily, what have you chosen for us and why?
So I chose a song called Hot Frogs on the Loose by Fred Smalls. This is not, let me say, like my favorite song or anything, or like indicative of my music taste, but it is an artifact of Oak Ridge history that is, I think, both amusing and telling. So it's a funny story about radioactive frogs hopping around and like cars running over them. That's what the song is about. It comes from 1991. There was this spate of radioactive frogs hopping around Oak Ridge that had escaped from a wastewater pond, and cars were running over them, and the tires were testing positive for radioactivity, and it made national and even international news. It's a funny moment in Oak Ridge history, but it's also, I think, indicative of part of this story that we sometimes forget, which is like, it's all still here. I mean, the nuclear weapons, like we have 12,000 in the world, you know, 1-2 bombs used was enough. But also the story of the nuclear contamination, I think, is less known and less talked about. I certainly didn't know anything about it when I started researching. I didn't know that I was going to learn that that beloved lake where I grew up swimming actually has like uranium in its sediment, right? So the funny story about hot frogs in 1991 is like actually an indication of the longevity of this history, of its pervasiveness, and of the fact that you can't contain this stuff, right? Like they say, oh, we're going to just make a nuclear weapon over here. Like, don't look over here. You can't keep it there. The frogs are going to hop out of the pond. You blow up a nuclear weapon and the fallout is contaminating someone else. So I find it amusing, but also a good lesson to think about in terms of this history.
Yes, a very profound context to begin a song about. Hot Frogs on the Loose by Fred Small and Emily Strasser. Thank you once again.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.